And good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Yesterday, first-degree manslaughter charges were filed against Tulsa, Oklahoma police officer Betty Shelby for the fatal shooting of an unarmed black man named Terrence Crutcher last week. Shelby, who is white, shot Crutcher after responding to a call about an abandoned vehicle blocking the road. Crutcher's family says he was having car trouble and waiting for help. Officer Shelby contends that Crutcher refused to obey commands. Video footage shows him walking away from officers with his hands up moments before he was shot in the chest. And in Charlotte, North Carolina, a third night of protests ended peacefully after violence erupted on Tuesday and Wednesday following the fatal shooting of an African-American man named Keith Lamont Scott by city police officer Brentley Vinson, who is also African-American. Police say Scott had a gun. His family believes he did not. Dashcam video of the incident has not been released to the public, but the family who saw it yesterday afternoon and the chief of police in Charlotte, Kerr Putney, both agree that the video does not definitively show Mr. Scott holding or pointing a gun. So we'll begin today with an update from both Tulsa and Charlotte. Corey Jones is a staff writer for the Tulsa World newspaper. Gwendolyn Gwen is a reporter for NPR member station WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
And Gwendolyn, let's start with you. Let's talk about first the pressure that Chief of Police Putney is under to release the video. He said this morning, I guess, that he would release it if there is compelling information. He said, if that's the case, we'll show it. What does he mean by that, and what do you expect to happen?
Well, at this point, they just held a press conference, and that is pretty much moot. And because the case has now been taken over by the State Bureau of Investigation, and according to Chief Putney, this was the last time that he was going to be able to release any information. From here on out, it will be a State Bureau of Investigation case, and they will decide what is released, when, and whether or not that video is being released that protesters and the family have called to be released.
So it is out of his hands, then, in terms of a decision on that?
Yes, and it's interesting, now that it is out of his hands, he was pretty adamant in other press conferences that he did not feel compelled to release the video, that he only felt compelled to let the family view the video. But in the press conference that was just held a few minutes ago, he seemed to have changed his tone a little bit now that it is out of the city's hands. He said that he seemed to hint that there was information he was going to release, but now he can't release anything, and he said that they go through a process and he wanted to gather more information, not hurt the integrity of the case, and that he, at this point, his hands are tied because it's no longer in his court.
What's the significance of the fact that the mayor of Charlotte is now supporting the release of the video?
Well, she also came out with a different tone than from what she earlier had said. She said that, I've been convinced that, you know, you need more information to protect the integrity of the case and to get the accounts of witnesses before releasing it. Earlier, she had said she was calling for transparency. Last night, she was saying she was leaning toward transparency. And then this morning, she said she's been convinced that you need more information. So they both have kind of taken a different tone than from what they did earlier. She initially had not seen the tape. I think yesterday was the first time that she actually saw the two videos that they have that they showed to the family.
One of the protesters, a young man, 26-year-old man named Justin Carr, was killed. He died a day or two after he was shot. And I understand police have charged someone in that case. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, he was standing in front of the Omni Hotel during the protest when it had gotten very chaotic, where tear gas was being fired at protesters and police were lined up in front of the hotel and other parts of the city. And it was not clear what exactly happened. And during a press conference yesterday, Chief Putney had said that he was going to look at video from that particular location more closely, because there had been allegations that it was not a citizen who had shot this 26-year-old young man, that it was a police officer. And there were lots of rumors swirling around this. So he said he was going to take a closer look, and then today at the press conference a few minutes ago, he announced that about 7 a.m. they had arrested a suspect.
His name is Raekwon Boerum, and he has been charged in the death of Justin Carr. The medical examiner also released a report. What did that say?
I have not seen the medical examiner's report. They have been not releasing a lot of information. And that was one thing that was mentioned to the chief, that reporters and everybody are making calls and we are not being able to get information and getting call back. So he said that he would be looking into that closely. So it has been a little frustrating trying to get information, but I have not seen the medical examiner's report.
Okay. As I understand it, they did identify the cause of death as homicide, but which is not unexpected, given that, there was a gun involved. Just in general, as we finish up here, Gwendolyn, what's the mood today as opposed to last night and the night before?
Well, I would say that it's kind of like a wait and see what happens later tonight. There are several peaceful, as they are describing them, protests or demonstrations, gatherings that are going to take place, one at a community college here, Johnson C. Smith University, held a gathering last night. And I would say that people are kind of have a wait-and-see attitude. The curfew is still on. Businesses such as even some of the banks, this is a large banking city, and some of them are even closed today. But one of the museums here is open, and they say they are specifically open because they want people to come in and talk about what's going on. And you have downtown more of a police presence. You don't see as many people downtown, but I've been downtown, and I didn't see during the day anything that would be threatening or that people should feel unsafe walking down there.
Gwendolyn Gwen is my former colleague here at WYPR. She was our education reporter for a few years. She's now with member station WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina. Gwendolyn, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And now we're joined from Tulsa, Oklahoma, by Corey Jones. He's a staff writer for the Tulsa World. Mr. Jones, welcome. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. So tell us what the mood is in Tulsa. It's a very different situation in Tulsa than in Charlotte, is it not?
It is very different. Everything from what we've seen has been pretty much peaceful. We had a similar incident happen about a year and a half ago with a deputy who shot an unarmed black man in the streets, and that remained peaceful throughout, and we expect it to continue that way here.
Now, I understand that Officer Betty Shelby, who has been charged with manslaughter, has turned herself into authorities. So the fact that she has been indicted, what is the next step in that process? It doesn't automatically mean she will go directly to trial, right?
No. There will be arraignments and a preliminary hearing before we go that far. I spoke with her defense attorney this morning, and right now they're deciding who's going to go forth with representing her. Said he's had offers for assistance from all over the country to help in her defense. So there's still much more court stuff to come before it actually goes to a trial.
Can you ascertain whether or not the fact that she has been charged has done anything one way or the other to change the mood of the town, to change people's general perception of whatever level of tension might exist?
It's kind of interesting. There's a couple different groups of folks out demonstrating yesterday after the announcement. Some were pleased with the charge. Others were not very happy with it. They thought it should have been murder. Others were quite fine with manslaughter one being filed and being filed so quick before the police investigation was complete. So the mood still, obviously there's still outrage at the situation, but folks have been peaceful. And I don't know if yesterday's decision, altered any of that significantly, because the demonstrations that were already planned are still continuing.
All right. Well, Corey Jones from the Tulsa World, I appreciate your time this morning, and we look forward to following your coverage of this very important story as it moves forward. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
It appears that I have misspoken. The medical examiner report that I alluded to was declared shooting a homicide was in the Tulsa case, not the Charlotte case. So I apologize for that. Tulsa, not Charlotte, in terms of the medical examiner's report. By the way, closer to home here in Baltimore County, a 21-year-old man named Tawan Boyd died on Wednesday following a physical confrontation with the police on Sunday. And earlier this week, the Baltimore County State's Attorney announced prosecutors would not file charges against officers for the fatal shooting of a 23-year-old woman named Corinne Gaines in August. Gaines was shot after a seven-hour standoff with police in her apartment. Officers say she pointed her gun at them. Gaines' five-year-old son was shot in the cheek during that altercation. Her family has filed a wrongful death suit against Baltimore County and the police officer who shot her. We'll bring you more on both of these stories as details unfold. Coming up ahead of the opening of the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington this weekend, we'll talk to Dr. Joanne Martin, the founder of the National Great Blacks in Wax Museum, and David Fakunle, a self-described servant of the city and fellow with the Baltimore City Health Department, about documenting the varied and sometimes painful African-American experience. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. And welcome back, everybody. It's midday on 88.1 WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Dr. Joanne Martin founded the National Great Blacks in Wax Museum with her husband, the late Dr. Elmer Martin, back in 1983. Since then, many thousands of people have been to the museum on the west side on North Avenue near Broadway. With the opening in Washington of the National Museum of African American History and Culture happening this weekend, I thought we'd invite Dr. Martin to share her thoughts about the new museum and her own approach to telling the rich history of the African American experience. Dr. Martin joins me here in Studio A, along with David Fakunle. He's a self-described servant of the city, a fellow with the Baltimore City Health Department, and a doctoral student at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. You are welcome to join the conversation here on Midday. You can give us a call at 410-662-8780. You can send us an email, midday@wipr.org, or you can drop me a tweet, @MiddayTomHall. Welcome to you both. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
So, Dr. Martin, your approach, your singular and unique and wonderful approach, I am a huge fan of Great Blacks in Wax. It's a great place. Tell us your philosophy about how you tell the story of Black history at Great Blacks in Wax Museum.
Well, of course, through the wax figure medium and wax figures that have a power all their own, but also being a museum where we are guided by my late husband, Elmer's philosophy that community development and cultural development go hand in hand. So within a backdrop of being in a fragile community in East Baltimore, the story unfolds, but also using wax figures for us right now to tell 5,000 years of history, using wax figures as the central focus, but putting those wax figures in compelling scenes, being willing to be a museum with a message, that's very, very important for us, and being willing to tell parts of the story that other museums have for a long, long time not been willing to tell. So the slave ship experience, lynching in America, talking about some of the challenges of life in America today and so forth.
And it goes right through the present time, too, doesn't it?
Right through the present time.
There's a wonderful figure of President Obama there.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. So from the slave experience through contemporary times.
Through contemporary times. And also following my husband's philosophy that if we fail to make those important connections between the past and the present, none of what we do makes any difference.
And again, I misspoke. I'm on a roll here for misspeaking this morning. You are on the east side, not
on the
west side.
My Oliver community members will forgive you.
Exactly. Well, thank you. I'm glad to be forgiven. And David Fakunle, you are doing research in Baltimore that is also telling a very interesting story. Tell us about the work you're doing towards your doctoral degree at Hopkins.
Sure. So a concept that I follow with pretty much all of my research is the social determinants of health, which is a very big buzzword at Hopkins, but I try to make it matter in my context. So I focus on aspects of the built environment and how that plays a part in the outcomes for people in certain communities. So specifically what I'm looking at is the availability of tobacco, which is work that I kind of fell into before my senior year of undergrad. What I'm looking at specifically for my dissertation is looking at the influence of race and median household income as that relates to tobacco outlet density, which is just the physical availability of tobacco in certain areas. So my aim is to look at Baltimore County and to look at Montgomery County, which are two areas that are primarily white but have different income levels. And we want to see what the influence of median household income is among two racially comparable areas. So they're both high white, but they have different income levels. So we want to see if there's a relationship between income and tobacco outlet density. Similarly, for another aim of my dissertation, I want to take two areas with similar median household income, but have two distinct racial compositions. So I'm going to look at Baltimore County and I'm going to look at Prince George's County. One is predominantly white, one is predominantly black, but they have similar median household incomes. So I want to see that when isolating median household income, but looking at the racial composition, is there a relationship between that composition and tobacco outlet density?
A lot of people have done a lot of thinking and screaming and yelling and blathering on about liquor stores and about the availability of alcohol in impoverished neighborhoods. But I think almost nobody has taken up this notion of how easy is it to get tobacco products.
Absolutely. So alcohol outlet density and just the availability of liquor stores, particularly in Baltimore, has been a hot topic for a while. Actually, my former advisor at Hopkins, Dr. Deborah Fairholt, and she's now at Michigan State University, was a big advocate for policy reform as it pertained to alcohol outlets. But like you said, there is very limited research on tobacco outlet density compared to alcohol outlet density. I think a lot has to do with just the perception of tobacco use. So I think we're all in agreement that tobacco is just not good. We know that, and we almost feel like that because we've come to that conclusion, oh, all the work has been done. But as you will see in Baltimore and a lot of urban, predominantly non-white, predominantly lower income areas, there is an abundance of tobacco products in those areas, and people are still using it at disproportionate rates compared to whites and those with higher incomes. So there's still a lot of work that needs to be done on that front, particularly in policy change to restrict the availability in those areas, because those areas are already fragile, as Dr. Martin said, as it is to begin with. So having an abundance of these detrimental products, whether it is tobacco, whether it's alcohol, whether it's lottery tickets, whether it's processed food, we can go on and on and on and on. That makes the disproportionate health outcomes, the disparities that we talk about a lot in public health research, even more profound.
Yeah, and of course, these are these social determinants of medical outcomes. You know, Dr. Martin, it makes your job so complicated and so nuanced, because when you tell the experience of a people from the slave ships to the current times, you've got to take all these things into consideration. For example, when you hear about, you know, these events this week in Tulsa and in Charlotte, as a director, as an historian, what's your response?
Well, it's very, very important that that we address those issues. And often I look at them from a historic perspective. The same conversations that mothers are having with their young boys in particular, their male sons, about being not confronting and how to approach a policeman, how to deal with the situation. Those are the same kinds of conversations that slave mothers and slave parents had with slave mothers in particular had with their children. Those are the same conversations that parents had with their children during the lynching period and during the Jim Crow period. Those are the same conversations that my mother had with my my older brother, who was born in the 40s. Therefore those are the conversations that parents are having with their children today. That resonates for me.
Dr. Joanne Martin is the founder and director of the National Great Blacks and Wax Museum here in Baltimore on the east side. And David Fakunle is a doctoral researcher at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. It's midday. If you want to join the conversation with Dr. Martin and Mr. Fakunle, you can give us a buzz, 410-662-8780. You can drop us an email, midday@wipr.org, or a tweet, @midday Tom Hall. David Fakunle, you're a a young African-American man in this city. Your reaction to what's going on, for example, these incidents in Baltimore County and in Tulsa and Charlotte, and unfortunately it's a long, long list.
Yeah, and it's forever growing, unfortunately. So for me, it's just further confirmation that the United States of America has yet to fully acknowledge the humanity of people of color. And it just gets more egregious, that disregard for humanity, every single day. I really had to think about how I wanted to phrase what I want to say and how I feel, because there's so many emotions that run through my mind, not only as a young black man, but the father of a growing boy of color, my son, who's black and Latino. So I think about his future. I think about what city I'm going to leave for him, what country I'm going to leave for him. We have a lot of trauma, and that's another buzzword, but it's true. We have a lot of trauma that a lot of people are dealing with. And the question that I can ask, and I always ask as a researcher, as an advocate, as an artist, is what do we do? I think we truly have to appeal to the universal spirit of humanity in a lot of people, and they're missing that. You know, we get caught up in misperceptions, and we get caught up in policies, and we get caught up in ideologies for which a lot of people are invalid. So I think about Colin Kaepernick, and I know that's such a hot topic with him kneeling for the national anthem.
He's the San Francisco Giants quarterback. Yeah, exactly. That has started something of a movement among professional athletes in the NFL and other places.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's a public acknowledgement that there are disparities and just inequitable treatment in such a holistic way. I know he's focusing a lot on police brutality. I get it. It's very visceral. It's very visual to see that when you see black bodies in the street being treated like trash. That's a very visceral sight, a very visceral reality for a lot of people of color to see that. And that's a traumatic experience. But again, as Dr. Martin said, this is just a cycle that's been going on and on and on since we were brought to this country against our will 400 plus years ago. You know, we've been commodified. So first we were cattle. We were products to be sold, to be used, to be bred for the building of this great nation, as so many people like to say. And then once that was outlawed from a policy standpoint, we were no longer of use. So they found different ways to control us. And all we've seen between 1865 and 2016 is just an evolution of those policies. And we've also seen the continuation of this false premise that blackness is evil, blackness is vicious, blackness is physical, blackness is violent, blackness cannot be controlled, it must be destroyed. And I think if anything, and I am so indebted to the National Great Blacks and Wax Museum for presenting this true reality of what it means to be black, not just in America, but to be black in this world.
Sure.
We are so much more than that. And that is all that I want people in the United States to see. We are so much more than that. And just at a fundamental level, why should a difference in melanin mean that I should be treated differently on a fundamental level?
Right, of course. And Dr. Martin, the capacity of history to address that narrative that David's just so compellingly and passionately put forth, which is a narrative shared by many, many people, that, you know, with now this opening on the Mall in Washington of what, by all reports, is this tremendous, tremendous achievement with the National Museum of African American History and Culture, which I think is an important distinction. Right. It's the same one that the Lewis Museum makes here in Baltimore for the Maryland African American or Maryland, you know, African American Museum of History and Culture. What is the capacity of history, and how can the National Museum move this conversation forward and inform people in an important way?
I think that as long as we remember that history does not occur in a vacuum, that the death of Emmett Till and the death of Trayvon Martin, that there is that connection. As long as we look at the whole Black Lives Matter movement, but understand that history will document for us whether the question is Black lives should matter as much as everybody else, or does it mean Black lives should matter, but they don't, or Black lives do matter. history has to address, look at those questions and ask those questions and make it clear that there's no single question being asked. And sometimes that gets lost in the shuffle. But it's the responsibility of history to look at those kinds of perspectives and look at the underbelly of the questions that get asked. It's important for us to pass on to our children, whoever those children are, that it is their responsibility to continue the legacy of this country, to continue the legacy of this world, and they do it better if they are just people, if they understand justice, if they understand equality. History can teach us that, because history can show us what happens when we don't. History can show us the fault lines, and that, for me, is the job of history. And it is the job of museums. The National Museum of African American History and Culture will do a tremendous job in telling that that story. But it's one of many, many museums across this nation. I had the privilege of visiting the International Civil Rights Museum in Greensboro, North Carolina, an outstanding museum.
Site of one of the first, important sit-ins in the civil rights movement, sure.
Yes, mm-hmm. An outstanding museum telling a powerful story that is every bit as essential as the powerful story told by Great Blacks in Wax. And the story told by Great Blacks in Wax, every bit as powerful as the story that will be told by the National Museum and all of the little stories that get told in museums. So that's one of the things. And for that museum to also be a repository of our history, the amazing collection that they've been able to amass that was languishing in basements or in the weather.
Yeah, some 35,000 pieces and arts and artifacts.
And so to have a repository is very, very necessary for the continuation of African-American history and of American history. So that's an important role that it will play as well.
And David, speaking of storytelling, we have an email from Ramey, who says, I know David's a very talented storyteller and musician, but I'd like to know how he incorporates his research into his storytelling or vice versa. Is it about switching hats or do the two converge easily? So you've got this scientist side and this creative performer side.
So everything that I do plays a large part in my goals, which is to promote equity, which is to promote equality, and to promote recognition of the humanity of all, especially people of color. So I have thought of ways to merge the two, but I really appreciate my work as a practitioner. So I know Ramey, so I know what she's alluding to. One of the things that I'm most proud of during my experience at Hopkins was starting an intervention program with my mother. She and I are both storytellers. We've been storytellers for a very long time. I've been a storyteller since I was about 8 or 9 years old, learning under the late great Mother Mary Carter Smith, who was Maryland's official griot. And I have taken that art form, which is a universal art form, and mine happens to be under the African oral tradition, and I'm using that to empower individuals who are dealing with some form of trauma. So for the past about 3 years now, it'll be 3 years in December, we've been working with individuals who are in recovery from substance abuse and giving them the opportunity to tell their story. And the reason is for there's a number of reasons. Number one, their story deserves to be told and it deserves to be heard. They deserve to be empowered and deserve to speak for those who are dealing with that trauma. I think of this as a drug epidemiologist, which I guess is my research title, the training that I'm receiving at Hopkins. We are way too comfortable with trying to quantify everything. So one of the things that I would do in the meetings is I would point to somebody and say, you are a black male, we'll say 29 to 35 years old, former drug user. And that's all we would ever know about you in drug epidemiology. I would like to think there's more to you than that. So tell that to us as researchers, tell that to us as policymakers, tell that to us as advocates. Tell us the full story of who you are. You are not just defined by the fact that you were a former substance abuser. You are not just defined by the fact that you dealt with domestic violence. You are not just defined by the fact that you have dealt with police brutality. There's so much more to who you are as a person that needs to come out. And the biggest thing for me is to focus on those qualities of your nature. So we incorporate virtues into what we do, which are these positive intrinsic qualities. So we talk about patience as a virtue, love is a virtue, the ultimate virtue. We talk about honesty being a virtue. These are things that are in every single person, regardless of what they do and regardless of the circumstances of their life. That should be the emotional foundation of your recovery from whatever your trauma is.
And Dr. Martin, speaking of trauma, one of the things that has been a great distinguishing characteristic of the National Great Blacks and Wax Museum is that you have held steadfast to your commitment to that neighborhood, which is a traumatized neighborhood, one of several on the east side. But folks may not realize that, you know, when tour bus fulls of folks come from all over the country, they do go to the Inner Harbor and they do all that, but they never pass up the opportunity to stop at the corner of North Avenue and Broadway. You have big plans for the museum, the physical plant of the museum. We've talked about it before on the morning show a couple years ago. Where do those stand? And you are hoping to expand the facility substantially, right?
To create a block-long museum, David and I are working hard to get interest in a arts and entertainment district in East Baltimore that uses Great Blacks and Wax as the anchor for that. We've demolished 16 of the 25 properties on North Avenue. We are working with our architect. We have an amazing design. We're working with our exhibit designers. We have a compelling story of over 250,000 years of history. So just moving things forward, but always continuing to address the desire to be a museum that provides jobs, that shows that tourism can thrive on a corner of East Bond Street and East North Avenue, and that there is so much more to that community that simply has not been tapped.
And you have had that kind of optimism and confidence since 1983.
And with David as someone who's going to follow me, it will never be lost.
Indeed. It is a pleasure to see you both. Thank you so much.
Thank
and
you.
I know Thank there's you. A lot of attention being paid to the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, but that doesn't by any means attenuate the great significance of the great National Blacks and Wax Museum here
Thank
in Baltimore.
You. Thank you.
Thank you both. Dr. Joanne Martin is the founder, along with her husband, Dr. Elmer Martin, of the National Great Blacks and Wax Museum. David Fakunle is a self-described servant of the city. He's a fellow with the Baltimore City Health Department and a doctoral student at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. It's midday on 88.1 WIPR. Looking ahead to Monday, the next installment of our series, Living Questions, in which we explore the role of religion in the public sphere. My guests will be Rabbi Daniel Berg of Beth Am Synagogue in Reservoir Hill and the Reverend Gray Maggiano of Memorial Episcopal Church in Bolton Hill. Coming up here on Midday today, the artist and activist Joyce Scott. On Wednesday, she was awarded a MacArthur Genius Grant. Joyce Scott, after a quick break, I'm Tom Hall. Stick around. Back to Midday on 88.1 WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. We are in the process of trying to get in touch with our good buddy Joyce Scott. We're not able to do that quite yet, but we are working on it. And as soon as we do, she will join us to talk about very exciting news that she's one of 23 recipients of the 2016 MacArthur Genius Grant for this year. So we are working on that. And while we do so, we're going to continue our conversation with Dr. Joanne Martin, the founder, along with her husband, Dr. Elmer Martin, of the National Great Blacks and Wax Museum, as well as David Fakunle, who is a servant of the city, a fellow with the Baltimore City Health Department, and a doctoral student at the Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and an artist and storyteller. So, Dr. Martin, what I know you haven't been to the new museum in Washington. It's very difficult to get a time ticket to get in. I mean, it's going to be a while for a lot of folks to be able to get down there. What do you want to see? I mean, when you walk in there, what are you going to be looking for?
Well, for me, museums are learning places, and they are places of reflection. So I would like to know that that the history is presented in such a way that I can ingest it, I can reflect upon it, I can use how the architecture adds to the story or lends to the story. Those are the things that I look at as a museum professional and as a historian. I like to watch how children are interacting with the exhibits. What questions are they asking?
Yeah, that tells you a lot,
yes,
doesn't it? Yeah.
I like to know that it's not so overwhelmed by science and technology that children miss a lot of the heart and soul of the story being told. Or that if there is a lot of technology, it's managed technology so that there is some resource there that's going to tie the very, very important people, the ancestors, the patriots, all of those things that people were into what we want our children to walk away with. Because when they do walk away, I want to know that they have been so inspired that they want to make sure that that history is never lost.
And David, we do have Joyce on the phone. We're going to move to her in just a second. But as a master of the griot tradition, what kind of stories are you hoping to hear told at the National Museum in Washington?
I'll keep it very simple. I want the full story to be told, the history of people of African descent, people from the African diaspora in this world is a beautiful history, good, bad, and indifferent. That full history needs to be told. It can't be whitewashed, pun intended. I want people to have a full understanding of everything that we as people of color have contributed to this world, the struggles that we still deal with even today, but the resiliency, the strength, the hope that we still have for our children, for our future, to truly be integrated in this country and the world.
Well, David Fakunle, Joanne Martin, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank
I
you.
Very much appreciate it, and we will see you soon. I hope our paths
Absolutely.
Do cross soon. Thanks so much.
Absolutely.
It's now my pleasure to welcome to Midday my friend, Joyce the Genius. Joyce Scott lives in Baltimore. She's a jewelry maker, a sculptor, a performance artist, a writer, and a singer. And now she is a MacArthur Fellow, one of 23 recipients of this year's MacArthur Foundation's so-called Genius Grants. It's a $625,000 no-strings-attached award that honors her extraordinary creativity. She joins me on the phone from her home in West Baltimore. Joyce, how you doing today?
I'm well. How are you, Big Thomas?
I'm doing great.
And I'd like to make an amendment. If you call me a writer, if anyone sees my name on anything except an apology, run. Do not read it.
Well, you've written comedy. You've written run.
Yeah, well, that's more performance-oriented.
Yeah.
I did have a few forays into thinking that I could actually write something that someone wanted to read, not hear me speak, and it was wrong. It was the wrong idea from the beginning.
Well, you've got nothing to apologize for when it comes to winning a MacArthur Foundation grant. I am so happy for you. Congratulations.
Thank you.
This is terrific news. I mean, it's been a couple of days. Well, it's been actually a few weeks since you found out, the world found out about it on Wednesday. Has this sunk in? How you doing with this?
No, I still feel as if I'm going to throw up every day. Because now I can throw up money. But boom, boom.
Who says you're not a writer, Joyce? Come on.
But I really, it is such an enormous gift, blessing, and responsibility that I haven't really become sanguine. I'm not really that comfortable with it yet. But I think I'm up to the job.
I think you're up to the job, too. And it's important that you mention it is a responsibility.
Yes.
I mean, this does elevate your profile. It elevates people's inclination to be attentive to your work. What do you think that's going to mean for you as an artist moving forward?
I think I can't cuss so much publicly. I think I have to stop being, a potty mouth publicly. No, that's not really true. I'm going to keep cussing if I want to.
you can afford to now. Why not?
Yeah, let me say that I also was awarded the Baker only, I think, 2 weeks ago. And that's a wonderful award and a wonderful gift, and it's being embraced by basically the Baltimore, Maryland community.
And the Baker Artist Awards, we should remind folks, is an award that is given out here to artists in Maryland.
Yes.
You won a substantial prize, or a $50,000 prize, as a Baker Artist Award, and it's been going on, off the top of my head, I can't remember how many years. Very important award.
It's a very important one. Please don't be talking about money, because I don't want people coming to my house thinking they could get a loan or something.
Well,
I
it's
am
like,
a round boy girl, you know. But what I wanted to say is the embrace that you get from your community. I am 67. I'm the oldest MacArthur awardee this year. And so, I mean, I've been around for a long time. I know lots of people in the community, gone to school with folks. And so I'm very comfortable being one of Baltimore's artists. This MacArthur is the thing that really pumps up your presence nationally and internationally, whether you're out there doing it, or as you said, people are actually being more attentive to looking at the work, wanting to see it and talk to you about it. And that is a responsibility in doing it. And no matter what people say, not only do you represent yourself, but you represent who and where you came from.
And not only are you an artist of Baltimore, you are quite specifically an artist of the west side of Sandtown. You live very close to the epicenter of where the violence occurred in April of last year, and your commitment to that neighborhood, your commitment to that, to our city, has been longstanding, and I bet that's not going to change either, huh?
No, I use Louis Armstrong as one of my examples. He lived in the same house until he passed away in New York, and it wasn't a poor neighborhood, because I'm living in a working-class neighborhood because I'm a worker. But his point was about not leaving. And for me to run away from my own folks is actually for me to run away from myself, to what would I be running from? There isn't anywhere in the world now that isn't strife-driven in some way. So that I wouldn't be getting rid of. And I believe that you are in some way a welcoming kind of example of what can happen if you persevere. Lauren Cornish lives like 4 or 5 blocks from me.
Another wonderful artist, yeah. Sure.
Original homes are completely covered in mirror and stained glass. So every time those people in that block walk by that, they have this grandiose artistic experience. And he's known as the artist up there. I'm like the artist here. In fact, where I live is very close to Micah and Reservoir Hill, and so we're just littered with artists. You can't throw an apple without hitting an artist in the head. And so to be in this artistic be in a neighborhood where you can represent the arts and be an example of what a round-the-way girl from Sandtown can become if you just keep working. When I was younger, I lived in neighborhoods, and this is like 50s, early 60s, where this is really the profuse integration, which meant the doctors, the lawyers, the teachers, postmen, you know, my father worked at Bethlehem Steel. Everybody lived in the same neighborhood. And so there are examples of what you could actually be living next to you, right?
Yeah.
And I think that kind of migration away, which I understand, is harmful to us. And I don't really believe you can run away from yourself, as we're learning, as this city is really routing areas and sending poor people to the counties. I mean, come on, that's where people ran away too. Now what? Guys, now what?
Yeah, the artist Joyce Scott, she's a recipient of a MacArthur Genius Grant here in 2016, one of only 23, and as she mentioned, the oldest recipient of a grant this year at the age of 67. I couldn't help think of your mom,
yeah.
Elizabeth Talford Scott, who was herself a very acclaimed textile artist. She was a quilter.
Yes.
She died, I guess, about 5 years ago.
Exactly.
You mentioned your dad, who worked at Beth Steele. You got to be thinking that your mom is looking down from heaven and is one very, very happy lady today.
I can't tell you how many emails from people who knew my mom have said just that. Oh, she's yelling, she's jumping around. And I think my father will finally get it, because there's money attached to it. And he was one of those hard workers, and his sort of life was, now, oh, she got money. This is wonderful, Joyce.
Yeah.
I wanted to tell you this before our time is up, that another great blessing came to me. I'm one of the artists who is exhibited at the new African American Museum
that
in Washington.
That was my very next comment.
See, I'm telepathical too.
You are telepathical, a telepathical writer, I may say. But you know that, and that is huge. It is. There are 35,000 works collected in that collection.
Yes.
You have been to the museum, and one of your works is going to be there. That's an incredible honor as well. Tell us your impressions of the museum. You walked through it last week when it was still.
Well, I was in a wheelchair basically because I'm having trouble walking. But that too shall change. And I was having an artist push me, which made me feel kind of good.
Nice.
But,
nice, yeah.
I went with two close friends and another close friend who's also my gallerist, Amy Race, who's responsible for this work being at that museum. My gallery supporting me, Goya Contemporary.
From Goya Contemporary, right. Mm-hmm.
And firstly, you come up to it, and people say it looks like a crown, and I guess it does because of the reference to, I think, fabric and this beautifully, the cutouts on this coppery brass metal. But to me, it was like, I don't know, it's a very special kind of intergalactic spaceship or something. It's beautiful. It's enormous. So you get in, and it's enormous. And there's artwork everywhere. My work wasn't up then. And it's many, many, many floors. So you can start from the very bottom, which has a lot to do. I mean, it's very spiritual and prosaic that the bottom would have a lot to do with the very first history. And then keep moving up until you get to some more contemporary work, but still it's history everywhere. It's profoundly elevating. It's amazing to see people walking around in their finest, being absolutely proud. And it's evolutionary in regard to that. And it's next to the Washington Monument. I don't know how much more
yeah.
on the nose that can be to have a museum about African Americans next to a monument to the first president of the United States.
Indeed. I can't wait to see it myself for sure. What do you hope people will get from it? What are your aspirations for people of all cultures and all races to understand about the African-American experience once they've had the experience of being in this beautiful place?
Well, firstly, I agree with I did hear some of the guests from who were just speaking. I'm so proud that they show how important African Americans were to this culture and are to this culture that we live in, the American culture, mm-hmm. that we're not set apart from it. We're right in the epicenter of it. And the bigger thing is that because of that, this is African and American history as well. Yeah. And it's very important for people, I believe, who have separated themselves from that, no matter what their ethnic group, to go in and just see just how regal and important we were.
Absolutely.
Absolutely, of course, that's from true. Slavery.
Yeah.
I mean, people talk about slaves like they weren't superheroes.
Yeah.
You work all day dragging a bag that's not an Hermes.
Yeah.
Or Joyce,
that's all we have time for this morning. I'm just so glad that in your busy schedule, I know a lot of folks are trying to get in touch with you these days. We're so glad that you took a little time to come and talk to us today. Thank you so much and congratulations. This
you
is terrific
more.
News. Okay, thank you. Joyce Scott, one of 23 recipients of the 2016 MacArthur Genius Grant. We've got a link to information about Joyce's work on our website, WIPR.org/midday. Lunch for our midday guest today provided by Pen and Quill, located at the corner of North Charles and Landvale Streets in Station North, serving small plates, sandwiches, entrees, and an array of cocktails, wine, and beer Monday through Saturday starting at 5. Menu and reservations at penandquill.net. It's Maryland. It's midday here on WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Have a great weekend.